could mean slimming down even while eating the foods you love. Number three.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Spectator TV. We are going to be talking today about the big expanding news that is coming out of the Middle East. This morning, Israel has launched special operations into Lebanon, possibly in preparation of a far more serious ground invasion of Lebanon. This is part and parcel of its recent attempts in recent days to degrade Hezbollah, and it has had quite a lot of success, it seems, at doing that. But everybody is thinking about what might happen next and looking towards Iran, as we often do whenever Israel is concerned. To discuss this fast-developing and very complicated subject, I'm going to be joined by none other than John Mearsheimer, who is a leading light on international relations and a professor at the University of Chicago. John, thank you so much for coming on Spectator TV. I thought I'd start by asking, and I don't mean this to be antagonistic, and I'm sure you won't take it this way, but a few months ago, 4 months ago I think it was, we talked about escalation dominance and Israel. And you suggested then that Israel had lost or was losing its escalation dominance against Iran because there had been a tit-for-tat exchange in April. And you were saying Israel had come out worse from that and had not been able to prove that it had the dominance in escalation, which is an important thing for countries to establish in international relations. Do you think the last few days have proved you wrong?
No, I don't. Because if you read the newspapers this morning, Hezbollah is once again firing rockets at northern Israel. If Israel had escalation dominance vis-a-vis Hezbollah, it would have been able to shut down Hezbollah's firing of missiles into northern Israel. There's no question that Israel can do more damage to Lebanon and to Hezbollah than vice versa. Just no question about that. But the fact is that the Israelis want to be able to use their air power to solve the problem that they face vis-a-vis Hezbollah. They want to stop Hezbollah from firing missiles into northern Israel forever and ever, so that the 60,000 displaced people can move north. But they've been unable to do that. And of course, this is why the Israelis are now talking about a possible ground offensive into southern Lebanon to deal with the problem that way. But escalation dominance has to do with air power. And in the case of Hezbollah, it's quite clear that they don't have escalation dominance.
But if Israel is about to launch a ground invasion into Lebanon and is able to neutralize Hezbollah's ability to attack it with missiles, that would rather prove that Israel has the whip hand over Hezbollah, certainly.
Well, that's not escalation dominance, Freddie. Escalation dominance is all about using air power.
Yes.
Let's assume that Israel goes into southern Lebanon. To solve the problem, they basically have to either eliminate Hezbollah or they have to push Hezbollah so far north that it is in no position to attack Israel. Is it conceivable that Israel could defeat Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and push them far to the north? I think it's conceivable. Is it likely? I think the answer is no. I think they'll be going into a hornet's nest. And I think they have an army. The Israelis have an army that is worn out from what's happened in Gaza. It's just very important to understand here that they're not finished in Gaza. They didn't achieve their two principal goals in Gaza, or what their two principal declared goals are. Number one, to decisively defeat Hamas, which is alive and well, and number two, to rescue the hostages. They haven't gotten them back. So they're stuck in Gaza, and now you're talking about taking an army that's been at war for almost a year and sending it into a hornet's nest. Hezbollah will be lying in wait. And you want to remember also, the Israelis clearly scored a stunning tactical victory by decapitating the leadership of Hezbollah. There's no question about that. But they'll replace those leaders. And more importantly, there are 40,000 fighters in the South who are armed to the teeth with all sorts of weaponry and who have dug trenches and have built all sorts of capabilities into the terrain, which is rugged terrain to begin with, that'll make it very difficult for Israel to prevail in that conflict. And then if you take it a step further, even if Israel does prevail, they're stuck in southern Lebanon, maybe even in central Lebanon as well. They've been there, done that, and it didn't work out very well in 1982. And there's no reason to think it's going to work out well this time. And again, you want to remember that they still have their hands full in Gaza. So the Israelis are in a very tricky situation in terms of decisively defeating Hezbollah to the point where it can no longer launch missiles into northern Israel.
I wanted to pick up on that point about decapitating the leadership. Obviously, killing Nasrallah was a big deal. But as you say, he can be replaced. All the leadership can and will be replaced very quickly. However, it is quite a major humiliation for Hezbollah, which attaches a lot of pride in its leadership and its ability to defeat Israel. And that pride will have to be avenged, will it not?
Well, it is a humiliation for sure. And the key point, however, is that Hezbollah will stay in the fight. Israel is involved in a long-term fight here with Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, and now the Houthis. And this so-called axis of resistance is not going away. And Israel and the United States, two countries that are basically joined at the hip, are not going away either. So this conflict is going to go on and on and on. And both sides are going to face ups and downs. But the idea that what happened with regard to Nasrallah now presents an opportunity for Israel to remake the Middle East and fundamentally change the nature of this conflict is, in my opinion, a pipe dream. It's just not going to happen. This conflict is going to go on and on.
Well, as I said at the beginning, all eyes now turn to Iran again, as often happens. Iran doesn't yet have nuclear weapons. And in many ways, Hezbollah has been the closest thing it has to threaten Israel with to nuclear weapons. Now that Hezbollah could be degraded or possibly defeated by Israel, does this make Iran more likely to get nuclear weapons or more likely to push harder to get nuclear weapons?
I think there's no question that given recent events, and we're not talking here just about what happened on Friday, we're also talking about what happened back in April when Israel and Iran got into a shooting match. And remember, Iran struck Israel and Israel struck Iran. Given these events over the course of this year, I think the incentives for Iran to get nuclear weapons from a strategic point of view have increased significantly. The problem the Iranians face is that their economy is in bad shape. They have centrifugal forces at play inside the country that have to be addressed. And the Iranians understand that if they do acquire nuclear weapons, although it may make strategic sense, what will happen is that the United States and a lot of other countries will go to great lengths to punish Iran economically. And that will cause all sorts of problems inside of Iran. So I think there is a strategic incentive to get nuclear weapons for sure, given events of the past year. But at the same time, I think there is an economic incentive not to do it.
So you don't buy the argument that we've been hearing a lot in recent days that Netanyahu has pulled off or maybe about to pull off an extremely risky but very audacious move in the Middle East by exposing not just that Hezbollah is not as strong as people thought, but that Iran doesn't really have the ability to respond in the way a lot of people think it might do.
I think there's no question that the events of the past week or so demonstrate that Iran cannot come to the rescue of Hezbollah in any meaningful way. But I don't think there was good reason to think that Iran could help Hezbollah anyway. What could Iran do? Launch a massive strike against Israel for the purpose of helping Hezbollah? Even if they could do that, even if it made strategic sense for Iran to launch lots of missiles and drones at Israel, I don't see how that would really help Hezbollah. It would solve the Nasrallah problem. But the fact is that Iran is made to look weak as a result of what happened over the past few days. There's no question about that. But so what? What's the consequence of this? Do you think Iran's going to go away? You think the axis of resistance is going to go away? I don't think so. What happens when you suffer some sort of tactical defeat in a long-term war is you make adjustments and you try and rectify the situation. The axis of resistance, so to speak, does this, and the Israelis do this as well. You know, it's an iterative game. It's an action-reaction cycle. And Iran is in this one for the long term, and there's nothing that Israel can do to knock out Iran or, as I said before, to knock out Hezbollah. I don't think it's going to happen.
So you don't anticipate an escalation in the conflict then? You do not anticipate that we will be at war with Iran in the coming weeks?
Oh, I think it's very possible. It's, as you know, Freddie, very hard to say where this train is headed. And it is possible that, you know, Israel and Iran and then the United States will get into a shooting match. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. I mean, as I've argued for a long time, there's no question that the Israelis are trying to drag the Americans and the Iranians into a shooting war. And the Americans and the Iranians are not interested in getting involved in a shooting war. It's very clear that the last thing we, the Americans, want is a shooting war with Iran. We don't even want to get involved with Hezbollah. We've been trying to get the Israelis for a long time to cool their jets with regard to Hezbollah. So there's no question about that. But the Israelis may be able to suck us in. The Israelis may do something to Iran that necessitates an Iranian response, and that brings the Americans in. Who knows for sure? There's no question that the Israelis now believe they have the whip hand and they can really begin to sort of use that advantage against Iran and maybe even against Hezbollah. And where that all leads is very hard to say.
Well, America has in recent days moved more troops, more forces into the region. But it seems to a lot of people that Netanyahu essentially stuck two fingers up, not necessarily to America, but certainly to the Biden administration. He was in New York at the time when the Nasrallah strike happened. And Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, had been trying so hard, as you say, to kind of build a possible ceasefire between Hezbollah and Israel. And Netanyahu just blew that up spectacularly. This is a bit of a humiliation for the Biden administration, is it not?
To take it a step further, Freddie, there are just all sorts of reports that the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, is furious at his Israeli counterpart, General Gallant, for not notifying him beforehand that they were going after Nasrallah. I mean, we were told, so the story goes, immediately before the attack, but Austin expected much more notification. And he didn't get it. And supposedly he was outraged. But the question you have to ask yourself is, so what? The Israelis don't care. They basically own us. They can do anything they want. And we will just suck it up and go along with what they do. It's just the way it works here in the United States and in the West more generally, to include Britain. The idea that, you know, we're going to punish the Israelis for doing something that we don't like in this conflict is not a serious argument.
Well, does it then suggest that the limits of American power are becoming ever greater, in that America is not able to shape world events as perhaps it could have done 10 or 20 years ago, and looking not just at Gaza, but perhaps Ukraine as well?
This is an incredibly complicated question. First of all, most people in the West don't understand that there's significant limits to what you can do with military power under any circumstances, right? They're just real limits here. Most Americans and even most West Europeans have lost sight of that fact. And that's why we started so many foolish wars during the unipolar moment. We thought we could reorder the world or reshape the world in the West's image at the end of a rifle barrel. And that didn't work out very well, because, again, this is the limits of military power. Second, there's no question that with the rise of China and the resurrection of Russian power, that America's relative power position in the world has been diminished. There's just no question about that. Third point I'd make to you is you do not want to underestimate how powerful the United States is militarily and economically. We are a heavyweight. And the great advantage that the Israelis have is that they're joined at the hip with us. The Israelis could never do what they're doing in Gaza and in Lebanon without American support. These are American aircraft, American bombs. We give them huge amounts of money. We protect them diplomatically, right? So the Israelis have this great advantage that they're working with the Americans. But as I pointed out, Freddie, you know, you noted that I talked about Israel's declining escalation dominance, which is correct. Another point I made about all the trouble that Israel is in is that in the old days, back when I was young, and Israel was fighting wars against countries like Egypt and Syria, Israel could pretty much fight those wars by themselves. They really didn't need another country to help them fight the war. And if you look at what's happened to the Israelis, they have become heavily dependent on the United States. They were heavily dependent on the United States back in April to deal with the Iranian attack, and they're going to be heavily dependent on the United States if the Iranians attack again. Even if you look at what they're doing in Lebanon, they depend heavily on the United States. I believe we're giving them lots of intelligence and so forth and so on. So the Israelis benefit greatly from the fact that the United States remains the most powerful state on the planet.
But to a certain extent, diplomatically, it's an asymmetrical relationship, because America may be giving Israel lots of intelligence, but as you said, with this strike, it seems like America's very, very angry that it was left blindsided. And perhaps you see something similar in Ukraine, where America does support Ukraine, does provide military aid, and diplomatic support, but is sometimes catching up with its allies' strategy.
Sorry to interrupt the show, but if you enjoy what we do here at Spectator TV, then why not subscribe to the magazine as well? If you subscribe today, you get 12 weeks for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis and Waitrose gift card. You can sign up at spectator.co.uk/TV offer.
The Ukraine situation is fundamentally different, I think, Freddie, than the U.S.-Israeli situation. The United States has a relationship with Israel that has no parallel in history. We give Israel assistance unconditionally, especially when it comes to the Palestinians. And this is in large part because of domestic politics inside the United States. It's the power of the Israel lobby. We have a very special relationship, and there's zero evidence that there's going to be any diminishment in American support of Israel moving forward. And indeed, I would argue it's likely that we will increase our support for Israel over time, because Israel will need more and more support. Ukraine, the train is going in the opposite direction. Support for Ukraine is withering away in the West, and especially in the United States. And if Donald Trump gets back in the White House next January, the Ukrainians are in real trouble. But even if Kamala Harris defeats Donald Trump and Kamala Harris becomes the president, she will face a devil of a time getting financial support from Congress for the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians' situation vis-a-vis the West, and here we're talking mainly about the United States, moving forward looks actually quite bleak. So not only are they suffering on the battlefield in egregious ways, if you look at their support base, which is the West, there are all sorts of reasons to think that Ukraine is in deep trouble on that front as well.
Well, you're quite right to point out they're fundamentally different conflicts. And so far, they've been pretty self-contained as conflicts, Israel in Gaza and the Ukraine war. But if there is a major escalation in the coming days, as you conceded, is a possibility with Iran, and we could find ourselves in a situation where China and Russia are forced to become more involved in these conflicts, partly just geographically because Iran is closer to Russia, but also because of Russia's interesting relationship with Israel and interesting relationship with Iran.
Yeah. The key word here is involvement. What does involvement mean? I think that there's no question that the Russians are already helping the Iranians. I mean, there's all sorts of evidence they've been giving them, you know, air defense systems, intelligence gathering capabilities, and so forth and so on. I think the Russians have a vested interest in doing that, because what's happened here is that the United States and the West more generally have basically driven the Chinese, the Russians, the North Koreans, and the Iranians close together. They all, you know, have a deep-seated interest in working together to counter the United States and its allies around the world. And appropriately, the Russians are supporting the Iranians. But the really interesting question, which is what I think you're getting at, is whether or not the Russians are likely to get dragged into a fight that involves Iran on one side and the United States and Israel on the other. I find that hard to imagine, and in large part because the Russians have their hands full in Ukraine. If you're playing Russia's hand, the last thing you want to do is, you know, incur a significant military commitment to fight in Iran against the United States and Israel, two formidable adversaries at this point in time. So I think there's no question the Russians will support the Iranians by giving them military equipment, maybe helping them diplomatically, and maybe even giving them some economic assistance. But I don't think they're going to join the fight. And I certainly don't think the Chinese will join the fight. I don't think they have the power projection capability. And I think it's really the last thing they want to do.
So if we see the world as the Gang of Four, as some people are now calling them, which would be Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, they have a shared interest in defeating Western interests. But they probably don't want to get dragged into a conflict with Israel and the United States right now. And in fact, that's what Israel is banking on.
That's true. But the question you have to ask yourself, Freddie, is what can the Israelis do to take advantage of that situation? Let's say Israel has its gun sights on Ukraine. On Iran. We all agree. But what are they going to do? They're going to attack Iran? What targets are they going to hit? What are going to be the consequences of attacking Iran? They're not going to knock Iran out. Can't deliver a decisive blow against Iran. Iran is not going away. And Iran is going to continue to be an adversary of Israel. And Israel is going to continue to be an adversary of Iran. And Iran is going to continue to find clever ways to support the axis of resistance. So in my opinion, there's no clever strategy that Netanyahu can employ to effectively hurt Iran. I mean, am I missing something here?
Well, I suppose the obvious thing would be to bait America into the conflict. If Iran attacks Israel in a way that triggers an American response, that drags America, because America does have the power to change Iran fundamentally.
Do we? What would we do? I mean, we go in there and we drop lots of bombs, do lots of damage. But what would be the consequences? These kind of bombing campaigns never have the strategic effects that they're designed to have. I mean, the United States during the Vietnam War bombed and bombed and bombed. And what effect did it have? There are just real limits to what you can do with what I would call punishment campaigns. And the Israelis have found this out themselves. I mean, are we going to turn Iran into one giant pile of rubble? I don't think so. And also, to get back to your question on the nuclear issue, I think if the United States were to attack Iran in a serious way, and Israel were to do the same, that the Iranians would then get nuclear weapons. My point about the economic constraints, I think, would be overridden in those circumstances. And if you're an Israeli, you have to ask yourself, is that in your interest? I think the Israelis have made it clear for a long time now, and we have certainly made it clear as well, that we do not want Iran to have nuclear weapons. Okay, if you don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, then probably the smart thing to do is not attack it with a major conventional air offensive. That kind of campaign, it would seem to me, is highly likely to lead Iran to acquire nuclear weapons. You just don't want that. You want the present situation to continue for as far as the eye can see.
But if I could continue my dangerously neocon line of questioning, I mean, you could militate the Sunni states that don't like Iran more aggressively against Iran and therefore constrict Iran's power and ability to shape things in the region, and deter the Shia axis of resistance and degrade it.
I'm not sure that you can do that by attacking Iran. I think, if anything, what's happening here is that sympathy in the Islamic world, broadly defined, is shifting in significant ways against the United States and certainly against Israel. Israel is becoming a pariah state all around the planet. It's quite clear that the United States is feeling the effects of this in Southeast Asia, where we're trying to contain Chinese. It's quite clear that, Islamic countries like Indonesia and Malaysia are not happy with the United States at all, and that this is causing us diplomatic problems. So I think when you start talking about shifting the Arab countries in the Middle East against Iran, shifting countries like Saudi Arabia against Iran because you bashed Iran, it's not likely to work. As I said before, it's also likely to lead Iran to get nuclear weapons. And as you well know, Saudi Arabia has said that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, they're getting nuclear weapons. And if Saudi Arabia gets nuclear weapons, will Egypt, Iraq and Turkey be far behind? I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. And again, this is one of the principal reasons we, the United States and the Israelis as well, don't want Iran to get nuclear weapons. The Israelis will tell you, of course, there's a simple way to deal with this, which is that if Iran goes down the nuclear road, we just destroy all their nuclear facilities. But almost everybody I know who has studied this issue says that you may be able to do that in large part in the short term, but in the long term, you will not be able to prevent them from acquiring nuclear weapons because they'll hide their capabilities and put them in mountains and make them hard to get, and they'll eventually get nuclear weapons. They clearly already have the technology. I mean, they're about 2 or 3 weeks away from where they have enough fissile material for a bomb. So it's very late in the game here, and you're not likely to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons by bombing the place. But, many Israelis and many Americans seem to think that you can do that. This all gets back to my point about the limits of military power. As somebody who spent 10 years of his life in the U.S. military, one thing I learned was that militaries are very blunt instruments, and there are limits to what you can do with them. If you're any country on the planet, you want to have a big and powerful military. It's the best means of guaranteeing your survival. There's no question about that. So I'm not against having a big military, no matter what country you are. You do want to have a big military. But you better be very aware of the limits of what you can do with that military.
And isn't the real lesson that Western policymakers never learned this lesson that you're describing? I mean, we see that in Iraq, we saw it in Afghanistan. With Iran, you have the same risks, but plus potentially nuclear conflict. Isn't the real lesson that we in the West never appreciate the limits of military power?
Yeah, I think that's especially true of the United States. And I think it's because the United States is so powerful. And this was certainly true during the unipolar moment. I mean, by definition, we were the only great power on the planet during the unipolar moment. And if you look at the geographical location of the United States, you know, we have weak neighbors on our borders, weak neighbors in the Western Hemisphere. We have two giant oceans on our east and west, to our east and to our west. And we're free to do foolish things because we don't pay a significant price. And it's usually other countries that pay a significant price. It's very interesting, but if you look at what's happened as a consequence of the Ukraine war, the United States' economy has hardly been hurt at all. In fact, one could argue that it's benefited from the Ukraine war. It's the Europeans, our allies, who have suffered economically from that war. And of course, the Ukrainians as well have suffered enormously. And the Russians have even suffered, but not the United States. The United States is an incredibly powerful country, and it has this sense of invulnerability, this sense that it can do pretty much anything it wants. And even if it doesn't work out, it doesn't pay a significant price. And I think this is what allows us the luxury of doing foolish things with our military. And with regard to the Israelis, their great advantage, or one might argue disadvantage, is that they can do foolish things because the Americans will always back them out or back them up. If the Israelis were really on their own, I would believe they would be a lot smarter from the strategic point of view, because they would have to be. I've spent a lot of time studying how Israel was created, going back to the early part of the 20th century, and then watching David Ben-Gurion and the founding fathers of Israel create this state. These were very savvy, very smart strategists, right? These were people who understood the limits of their power and worked in very smart ways to create the state of Israel. But if you look at Israeli leaders today, in my humble opinion, from a strategic point of view, they often act in very foolish ways. And this is from Israel's own, in terms of Israel's own self-interest. And I think that the reason the Israelis are careless is that they believe that they can do almost anything. And even if they get into trouble, Uncle Sam will come to the rescue. And of course, they're correct.
So, I mean, even though you're saying they're strategically foolish, it's not that foolish, is it? Because they are correct. They're not wrong to think that America will always support them, and therefore they can get away with strategic acts of aggression because they have America's support.
Oh, yes, I agree with that completely. And as I tried to emphasize before, the United States has this special relationship with Israel that's unparalleled in history. We give them unconditional support, and there is no reason for Israelis to think that that situation is going to change. For the foreseeable future, we are going to support Israel no matter what. But again, you have to ask yourself, is that good for Israel? And we have not talked about what's happening inside Israel. What is the state of Israel today? But Israel is a country that is in deep trouble.
Well, let's talk a bit more about that, because Netanyahu, it was thought, was badly, his weakness was badly revealed by October 7th. There was a lot of talk about unhappiness towards him. But in recent days, we're hearing that, you know, he may get away with this war effort. Him and Gallant have sort of managed to orchestrate this very audacious attempt to fight a war on potentially five fronts, and that possibly his popularity will grow again. Do you go along with that?
Sure. I think it's absolutely true, but it's beside the point. We don't really care here about Netanyahu's popularity. the question that really matters is, what about the state of Israel? What about the body politic? Where is it at today? That's what matters, not Benjamin Netanyahu's political future. And it's a country that is in really deep trouble. First of all, it's stuck in Gaza. It has not defeated Hamas. It has not gotten the hostages back. And despite its great success in decapitating Hezbollah, it has not defeated Hezbollah by any means. And it's now talking about invading Lebanon, which will not turn out well. And with regard to the axis of resistance, it's in a long-term war that shows no signs of going away. Then when you get inside Israel and look at what's happening, the economy is in terrible shape. Moody's has downgraded its standing for the second time. All sorts of people inside Israel are talking about all the businesses that have closed, the lack of tourism and what that means, and so forth and so on. So economically, it's in real trouble. All sorts of people have left the country. All sorts of people are talking about leaving the country. And then you have these powerful centrifugal forces involving secular Jews and religious Jews, sorts of people like Smotrich and Ben-Gavit, who have a particular view of Israel that's fundamentally at odds with the view of more secular, more moderate Israelis. And you want to ask yourself where that train is headed. You want to remember that before October 7th, when there was this huge kerfuffle over the question of changing the Constitution, there was talk in the Israeli media all the time about a possible civil war. This is before October 7th. And this just highlights the centrifugal forces that are at play inside of Israel. And when you marry that again with the state of the economy and the foreign policy situation, Israel is in, I think, deep trouble. And there's no sign that any of this is going to change in a positive way anytime soon.
Well, John, that's all absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for coming on Spectator TV. Before I leave you, I did want to just ask you about one more question to do with Zelensky and Ukraine and America, which was that in Zelensky's trip to America last week, I think the first place he visited, or one of the first places he visited, was an arms factory in Pennsylvania. And I thought that was a very telling thing for the Biden administration, Biden-Harris-Waltz administration, if you like, to show, because obviously Pennsylvania is a very crucial swing state, and it showed how for America foreign policy is dictated by electoral concerns as much as anyone else.
Yeah, I think that, you know, from a Biden administration and from Kamala Harris's campaign's point of view, this made sense. But it was disastrous for Zelensky because it enraged the Republicans across the board. And the last thing that Zelensky needs at this point in time is further antagonism with the Republican Party, especially with Donald Trump. I mean, Pennsylvania, as you said, is a swing state. It's a critically important state. And Trump and Harris are battling each other there. And for Zelensky to go to Pennsylvania and do something that made it look like he was supporting Harris against Trump was a remarkably bad move. I think, by the way, that Zelensky did not know what he was doing.
Yeah.
Simply because he just doesn't know American politics. I think he just went as a good faith effort to, work with the Biden administration to garner support for the war. I don't think he understood that he was, in effect, shooting himself in the foot by going to this arms factory in Pennsylvania. But nevertheless, he went there, and he had trouble setting up a meeting with Trump as a result, as you remember. Mm. And he basically begged Trump to meet him, and Trump met him. And of course, Trump treated him with disdain, as you would expect. And this is a harbinger of big trouble to come for Zelensky if if Trump wins back the White House. So this was really unfortunate for Zelensky.
Well, one thing we can be sure of is that there will be big trouble to come one way or another. And I hope that we'll be able to talk to you about it again, John. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Freddie. I enjoyed talking to you very much.
Great pleasure.